This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This year, we brought you plenty of interesting reports and conversations, and as we leave 2019 behind, we'll listen back to some of those that stood out. We'll hear how a school nurse broke the rules to save a life and later changed the law. We'll learn about problems like a lack of affordable housing and sex trafficking. We'll also find out why it can be difficult to make state government more efficient. We'll hear inspiring stories like that of Perry Klein. He served time in prison, then turned his life around, and we'll hear what higher education needs to do to help in the rehabilitation process. Also, we'll listen to the story of a woman here in the U.S. for decades, but who has now been deported and the impact that's had on her family. And we're not above a lighthearted look at a controversy over how to identify Governor Pritzker. All that and more in the best of 2019 Statewide. Welcome to a special episode of Statewide. For our final show of the year, we listen back to some reports and conversations that spotlight issues and even a few that inspire. I'm Sean Crawford. Let's get started with a report from Sam Dunklaw that we aired last January. Governor Rauner was about to leave office, but before doing so, he granted a pardon to a man wrongly convicted of attempted murder. What made the clemency unique was that Grover Thompson is deceased.
John Hanlon directs the Illinois Innocence Project at the University of Illinois in Springfield. It's a legal group whose mission is to free people who are sitting in Illinois prisons for crimes they didn't commit. Since 2003, they've helped nearly a dozen people prove their innocence. And this week, Hanlon spoke to the media about one other person they'd helped.
Welcome to this gathering pertaining to the posthumous grant of clemency based on actual innocence that has been granted to Grover Thompson.
Almost every other time Hanlon has announced something like this, he's had his client standing right next to him. But not this time. That's because Grover Thompson died behind bars more than 20 years ago. Hanlon says his group usually doesn't look for posthumous cases like this one, but when Thompson's family came calling, they answered.
Grover Thompson was just as wrongfully convicted as any living exoneree. Grover Thompson suffered all the different things that exonerees suffered. There's only one difference. He didn't get to walk out.
Thompson was a black man from Chicago who seemed to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. On September 7th, 1981, he was traveling on a Greyhound bus, which stopped before sundown in the southern Illinois town of Mount Vernon. Thompson didn't like to travel at night, so he got off the bus and looked for a place to sleep, settling on a nearby post office. At nearly the same time, a woman in an apartment building across the street was stabbed by an attacker who had snuck in through her bathroom window. He escaped before police arrived, but witnesses said the assailant was black. Since Thompson was the only black man found near the scene, they pegged him as the suspect. Before long, an all-white jury gave Thompson 40 years in prison. Thompson's nephew, S.T. Jameson, remembers when he heard the news.
It was so depressing, so chilling, that a man like him had been accused of such a heinous crime.
Jameson says Thompson was a funny, hard-working man who played blues on the guitar like nobody could.
Every time I go home to Mississippi, my family, we laugh and tell jokes about some of the things he said and did.
Nothing seemed to add up in Thompson's case. He wasn't wearing the same clothes witnesses said the attacker wore and had no trace of the victim's blood on him anywhere. But he sat in prison for nearly 14 years anyway, dying there in 1996. That's when retired police lieutenant Paul Eccles came in. He'd been investigating another man, Tim Kreicher, for a string of murders and rapes. Kreicher had been in prison for other crimes when, in 2008, he confessed to stabbing a woman in Mount Vernon, the same crime Grover Thompson had been picked up for.
This is not what you want to hear. You don't want to hear that somebody else has been arrested for a crime that he had committed in this case.
In 2012, Grover Thompson's family partnered with Eccles and the Innocence Project and put in a formal clemency petition to Illinois' Prisoner Review Board. By state law, the governor has the final say on granting clemency, which he or she can give at any time. Though former Governor Rauner initially denied Thompson's petition in 2015, he reversed course just days before he left office, giving him a full pardon. S.T. Jameson says the pardon means just as much to his family, even if it's 23 years after the fact.
We cannot bring this beautiful man back, whom we love so much, but we can clear his name, and that's been what the family has wanted to do all these years.
Lieutenant Eccles apologized on behalf of those who put Thompson away, saying police like him really do want to see the right thing happen.
We have the ethical responsibility to get it right, because when we get it wrong, the true suspect goes on and commits crime.
According to the National Registry of Exonerations, Thompson is one of less than 24 people nationwide who have been given pardons after their death. I'm Sam Dunklaw.
A Chicago-area family said goodbye to its matriarch over the summer after she lost her battle with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. 66-year-old Julie Bartolome came to the U.S. more than 30 years ago, but this year she was deported back to her native Philippines. Esther Yuji King brought us the family's story.
Back in 2000, 2 years after his first wife passed away from breast cancer, Edgardo Bartolome got a call from an unknown number. It was a woman's voice.
When she called me, the first question she asked is, how's your kids? And I said, who are you? She did not answer me. She asked, how's your kids?
The woman on the other end of the line was Julita Rafael, an old family friend from his province in the Philippines. She's better known as Julie.
And I asked her again, who are you? And when she says she's Julie, I'm confident this is the woman that I need to marry.
Edgardo, a U.S. citizen living in Illinois, took a trip to Florida to visit her. They fell in love. Julie, a petite woman with a wide smile, had arrived in the United States in 1988 as a domestic worker. She overstayed her visa, applied for asylum, but was denied. So she was ordered to return to the Philippines. She appealed her case, but a judge dismissed the appeal. Julie's lawyer at the time never told her about the judge's decision, that the removal order was still in effect. At around the same time, Julie moved to Illinois, married Edgardo, and they began raising his two kids together in northwest suburban Mount Prospect. Edgardo's 33-year-old son, Aaron, says everything changed when Julie came into their lives.
The whole environment of our house changed. I mean, when my mom died, it was just like quiet, and my sister and I, our relationships with our dad was just awkward. But then when he married my stepmom, the whole home changed. It was like we were a family, and there's like laughter, and my dad is happy.
He says Julie and Edgardo, a part-time pastor of a small Filipino church on Chicago's northwest side, were a unit.
Every time I come home, I see them, they're just praying in the living room, and they watch like Filipino music shows together.
In 2002, the couple filed a family petition called an I-130. The document essentially acknowledged that the marriage was valid and the family could apply for a green card for Julie. But because she had a removal order, she had to wait 10 years. The Bartolomes couldn't afford a good immigration lawyer, which is a big problem given how complex immigration laws are. In 2017, thinking they had to refile the I-130 to get Julie her green card, Edgardo resubmitted the petition.
They got invited for an interview downtown. And my parents were very happy. They were celebrating. They were thanking God. It was like approved, and he stamped it, and it was like a happy time for them. And then another officer came and arrested my stepmom.
It turned out their I-130 application had actually done the opposite of what they had hoped. It drew the attention of ICE. After Julie's arrest, Aaron says it was chaos.
We had no idea where she was, and my dad was freaking out.
One brief call where she mentioned the word McHenry finally gave them a clue. She was at the McHenry County Jail in Woodstock, Illinois. After more research and phone calls, Aaron figured out how to set up commissary accounts so Julie could pay for things while she was in jail. Phone calls and video chats, toothpaste and soap.
Thank God that we have a lawyer funded by our friends and family. Thank God that, you know, I speak perfect English and I can talk to people. But there are some people that don't have that.
Aaron said Julie kept her spirits up. She even mentored fellow detainees with her limited English. Lots of young women, he said, mostly Latina. Sometimes when Aaron video chatted with his stepmom, she'd let the other ladies talk to him too. I got to speak to Julie about a month after she arrived at McHenry. Her new lawyer, a first-year associate and family friend named Catherine Del Rosario, patched me into the jail phone line.
I have Esther on the phone. She's a journalist. And she wanted to ask you some questions.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, thank you. How are you?
Julie was polite and upbeat. She told me she'd been spending her days attending Bible study and praying, and that she talked to her husband every night at around 6. And then I asked her what she missed the most.
I miss all my loved ones. I miss my husband. children, church, ministry of the Jesuits, all of that.
She said she missed Edgardo, the kids, her church. While Julie was in jail, Del Rosario, the lawyer, pulled out all the stops. She pleaded with the ICE officer. She filed multiple requests for a stay of removal. She asked ICE's office of the chief counsel to review the case, and she called lawmakers to intervene. Last Wednesday, Del Rosario got a curt email from the ICE officer. Julie would be sent back to the Philippines the next day. He told the family to come to an ICE facility in West Suburban Broadview no later than 8 a.m. Pack her bags, he said, and they should weigh no more than 40 pounds.
Okay. Are we ready now?
Yeah.
Okay.
On Thursday morning, I rode with the Bartolomés from their home in Mount Prospect to the ICE facility. Edgardo, a broad-shouldered 64-year-old with a full head of close-cropped white hair, was wearing a blue button-down tucked neatly into his jeans.
It's hard to explain, but Julie and I, we have a lot of respect to the authority. At the same time, it hurts. It really, really hurts.
In the car, Edgardo told me that the night before, he drove 40 miles to McHenry Jail just to video chat with Julie. The jail doesn't allow face-to-face visits without a court order. She told him to stay healthy. He told her not to fuss if her relatives in the Philippines had a messy home. She asked him to pack her vitamins and supplements for her osteoporosis. And he told her he loved her. And then he came home to pack. He slept a couple of hours and woke to his daily alarm clock set for 3 a.m. That's when he gets up for his job as a custodian at Moody Bible Institute, where he makes about $450 a week.
We never apply for food stamp or any kind of help from the government. I work hard to provide for my family. Now that she's going home, we accept this. It is God's will, because we obey God and we obey the law of the land. It's just sad, that's all.
Edgardo told me he's been a lifelong Republican and voted for President Trump in 2016. Next year, he said, he will not be voting for Trump. We got to the ICE facility at around 6:30 a.m. Del Rosario arrived a few minutes later. It was an unusually cool August morning, with the sun coming up over the printing company across the street and the factories humming around them. The family stood on the sidewalk and swapped stories with Del Rosario.
I talked to her last night, and the first thing she goes, "Did you tell Ed? What did he say? Maybe don't tell Ed." I was like, "I have to tell Ed. He knows now." She said, "I hope he eats. I hope he stays healthy." I said, "Let's think about you today."
She always, "Don't cry." I said, "Why? When the people see, they lose hope." But last night, I cannot hold it. She controlled herself too. She controlled herself.
Aaron walked up to the door to ask if Julie had arrived. "Not yet," they said.
There's a sign on the door, and it says no contact between detainees and families or inmates. But I'm hoping someone has the authority or the power to grant us that, just so we can say bye and give her a hug, you know.
Del Rosario got updates from her firm, where her supervisor was working with Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky's office until the very last minute to get a stay of removal. Edgardo talked about his faith.
God knows we're hurting, and God knows we're limited, fragile, weak. Of course, I will ask the Lord, how can I overcome? I have to be patient. I have to love God, to love people, endure, sacrifice.
At around 8:15, a van with no windows and a sign that said, "Do not approach," pulled up to the building and went inside the enclosed garage. 30 minutes after that, the guard called us over.
"Yeah, you just leave all your stuff and everything."
He told us to leave our phones and my recording equipment behind.
"Do you have your ID, Dad?"
"Yeah, make sure you got your ID."
"Well, it's okay."
And then we were inside. There was a lobby with dark blue walls, the American flag, and pictures of Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and Kirstjen Nielsen, the former Secretary of Homeland Security. A large plaque on the wall read, "With honor and integrity, we will safeguard the American people, our homeland, and our values." The family went into a drab visitation area, which had a window into an adjacent room. A female officer brought Julie in. The Bartolomés and Del Rosario cried and talked through a receiver. and they put their hands on the glass as if to touch each other. The guard and the officer picked through Julie's luggage, looking at all the stuff Edgardo had gingerly packed the night before. The officers pulled out the vitamins and told the family Julie couldn't take them with her. They were not prescription meds. More than once, Edgardo stepped out of the visitation room and walked over to the guard to plead through tears, "Can I please have my wife?" After about 10 minutes, the officer took Julie away. We began the drive back to Mount Prospect. I asked Edgardo what Julie had said to him.
She said, "Stay healthy, eat well, we'll see each other soon. Don't cry."
Aaron, what did she say to you?
She said to take care of my dad, take care of my sister Grace Joy, to be careful in the jiu-jitsu tournament. She wants me to tell everyone that she's thankful for all the love and the support. She's thanking God for them and praying for them. She loves them.
The rest of the way home, the Bartolomés talked about visiting Julie in the Philippines. They wondered how Edgardo would continue his ministry without her, and they talked about next steps, applying for an immigrant visa for Julie. And Edgardo warned his son about getting traffic tickets.
"Just be careful. It's not in our budget, all these tickets."
Later, Aaron told me his dad came home and fell asleep. He missed Julie's call from the airport, but got a voicemail saying she had boarded a flight that would arrive in Manila the next day. This week, a friend of the Bartolomés started a GoFundMe page for the family. Aaron says his dad is sad to be separated from his best friend, but at the same time, relieved that she's out of jail. They're weary from all the attention they're getting, but they said they want people to know how real families are being affected by this country's immigration policy. Aaron sent me a picture of Julie this week, a selfie that her sister took. In the background, their 82-year-old mom was clinging to her newly returned daughter. Julie's phone was visible on her lap, with texts from her loved ones in the United States. Esther Yunji Kang, WBEZ News.
We'll have more of our look back at some of the best of 2019 on Statewide. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Our education reporter Dusty Rhodes told us the story of a school nurse in Moline who had to make a true life or death decision. It was also one that could have been costly to her. She chose to violate a policy which could have meant her dismissal in order to save a diabetic student who had lost consciousness. Here's that story.
Low blood sugar can usually be cured with orange juice and a granola bar, but those snacks weren't working for the seventh grader sitting in Jennifer Jacobs' office.
Her blood sugar actually kept falling, so we kept pushing the snacks.
Jacobs is a nationally certified school nurse with 30 years of experience, 17 of those at Glenview Middle School. She was on her lunch break when the student came in, so her assistant, a licensed practical nurse, started the treatment.
Within probably 5 or 10 minutes of my returning from lunch, the student fell on the floor, wasn't seizing, but was tremoring, and her eyes were rolling back in her head.
Jacobs applied glucose gel inside the student's cheek, but those meds just slid right out of her mouth in a stream of drool. The student was crashing.
It was beyond anything that we could do.
Well, it was beyond anything they could do legally. Jacobs and her assistant both knew there was one more medication made specifically for such emergencies right there within reach. It's a hormone called glucagon, and once injected, it can help a diabetic recover from a crash.
It stimulates the release of stored glucose or stored sugars in the body. This helps to raise their blood sugar very quickly.
The problem was the only glucagon kit in the office belonged to another diabetic student, not to the seventh grader drooling on the floor. Could they use that glucagon kit to treat this student? To Jacobs, that wasn't even the right question.
As this was going on, I'm thinking, well, I could lose my RN license for this. I could lose everything. I'm putting the school district at a huge liability risk. I mean, it could have been hugely detrimental, but how do you not do this to save this girl's life? How do you not? It just comes down to that. How do you not?
So, time out. What could be the outcome if you didn't?
The progression for untreated severe hypoglycemia would be seizures and to stop breathing and to die.
Jacobs made a split-second decision. She grabbed that glucagon and injected the student. Paramedics arrived and had to administer a second dose of glucagon en route to the hospital.
This girl was crashing so severely that the one I administered wasn't even affecting her. Think what would have happened if I hadn't have used that one. That gives me goosebumps. That makes me nauseous.
You said that the student's family had not provided one and you'd been asking for one. Why had they not provided one?
There are so many reasons, so many obstacles. When you're talking buying all of the supplies needed for a diabetic to manage their diabetes, the cost is astronomical. And this family not only had their seventh grade daughter, but they have an eighth grade son, and the father and the mother all have diabetes. Three of the four are insulin dependent.
Jacobs called the other student's family immediately, and the school district replaced their child's glucagon the next day. The girl who experienced the hypoglycemic crash made a full recovery. But for Jacobs, that's not a happy enough ending. She persuaded her state representative, Democrat Michael Halpin of Rock Island, to file legislation allowing schools to buy glucagon and keep it on hand.
It just makes sense. We have a school-provided inhaler for students that have severe asthmatic reactions. And schools have EpiPens for severe allergic reactions. And we have Narcan to be used for opioid overdoses.
Lawmakers apparently agree with that split-second decision Nurse Jacobs made that day. As she would say, how could you not? I'm Dusty Rhodes.
And the legislation wound up becoming law this past summer. It's now in effect for school districts across the state. The Illinois Department of Corrections did not fare well in a state audit this year, and among the findings, the agency could not account for 3,568 pieces of equipment. Brian Mackey started looking at that finding and soon discovered a bigger story about the challenges of pursuing efficiencies in state government.
When you look at the Department of Corrections property database, items that can't be found are not declared missing. Rather, they're unlocated. Among the unlocated items at the end of the last budget year are a Coronado four-station exercise machine, two four-slice toasters, and a Heritage salad bar with sneeze guard. Some of the stuff seems clearly outdated and not likely to be of much use. Who wants a compact computer from 1999, let alone an IBM Wheelwriter 6 typewriter, which first entered state service in 1986? But there are also projectors, dozens of radios, and scores of newer computers that might be useful, or at least should be accounted for.
Property control is important, and your vigilance at that is very telling about your own accountability.
This is Frank Martino, Illinois' Auditor General. He says this problem is not unique to the Department of Corrections, that unlocated property is pretty common across state government.
You find that with a lot of the bigger agencies, Human Services. You'll find a lot of the same where you have property that may move between buildings.
Martino also says it's worth noting that just because property can't be located during an audit, that doesn't necessarily mean it's been lost or stolen.
Now, some of those might be that they took this chair and they put it in the other room and nobody changed it over. So it's not that they're in all cases missing. Theft is a small part of it, but very rarely, more times than not, it's they need better training, more people doing inventory and tracking.
Ultimately, better control of state equipment is about making government more efficient, which is an idea both Democrats and Republicans like to talk about.
The people that I've hired in my cabinet are looking within those agencies to find places in which we can bring some cost savings and efficiencies.
We need to see our expenses reduced before we can go to the taxpayers and ask for any more money.
We are very poor at delivering government services.
That was Governor J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat, talking last month to the WTTW show Chicago Tonight, and Republican State Representatives Grant Worley and Mark Batnick. Getting back to the Department of Corrections audit, here we have a state agency that lost, or at least can't account for, more than 3,500 pieces of equipment worth nearly $3.4 million. That sounds pretty bad, but I think it's worth taking a step back to consider the broader context. That 3,500 pieces of missing equipment is out of a total inventory of 180,000 items. It represents about 2%. Looking at the department's current year budget, it's worth just 0.25%, 25 cents out of every $100, which is not to say it's unimportant.
We should have a system that holds people accountable and also allows them to do their job correctly.
This is John Baldwin. He's been director of corrections for nearly 4 years. I caught up with him near the Capitol Rotunda. It's a little noisy from a rally happening nearby. When Baldwin talks about what it'll take to fix the problem with inventory management, it doesn't sound cheap.
All the stuff we're trying to do is paper and pencil based. We do have supposedly an inventory system that you can put stuff in, but you have to have somebody that has a computer to put these things in.
Baldwin says in corrections, people with a computer are in short supply.
Out of our 13,000 employees, there's 3,500 who have access to a computer. I find that amazing in a negative sense.
Amazing, perhaps, but potentially expensive to rectify. And remember, unlocated property may not be a true cost if the equipment is obsolete and the real issue is paperwork rather than loss or theft. But even if we could eliminate that cost, in terms of solving Illinois' fiscal problems, it would be a teaspoon in a swimming pool. I'm Brian Mackey.
Like many people coming out of prison, Perry Klein never thought he'd go to college. Klein beat the odds, and as Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines explains, his story shows how important higher education is after prison and how much more colleges and universities need to do to support those formerly incarcerated individuals.
Klein grew up in Chicago. As a teenager, he was wrongly accused of a robbery, and he spent months in juvenile detention for a crime he says he didn't commit. And after he was released, he says his high school failed him.
I really didn't feel like I had a lot of support, you know, from the school, you know, because of that traumatic experience. Nobody came to me and gave me any counseling. I didn't go to a school like that.
Without the proper support he needed, Klein dropped out. He started hanging out with gangs and committing crimes. He spent time in Illinois prisons, and he got addicted to heroin. Then, in 2013, something happened that made Klein realize he needed to change. A friend overdosed on heroin in front of him. Instead of going to get help, Klein left to get more drugs. His friend later died.
You know, I could have saved him, you know, but I was thinking about getting that next one. I remember getting down on my knees. And I remember praying to God and asking me to get me out of this madness. And he did.
Klein got out of Chicago. An old girlfriend bought him a bus ticket to Champaign. When he arrived, he was homeless and in withdrawal. It was a pivotal moment for Klein. Then came another one. He started going to Narcotics Anonymous religiously. He told one of his friends from NA that he wanted to go to college.
One day, I was helping him move. And after we got through moving, he drove me right up to Parkland College. And he said, get out. He said, go register for school. And I did it.
When he enrolled in the college, he placed into a lot of remedial classes and he struggled.
Math was like my worst subject ever. So I had started real low in math. It was like straight humiliation. But I stuck it out, was there every day, you know, passing the test and going to the next level.
Sticking it out is unusual for formerly incarcerated students. That's according to one of Klein's advisors at Parkland College, Larry Taylor. He says Klein had a lot of factors working against him.
Black males in general are most at risk of not graduating and earning a degree. You couple that with being formerly incarcerated. So most of those students that I've worked with that were incarcerated, I can't think of maybe one or two that actually completed their academic goals.
But Klein got something he needed from the faculty and staff at Parkland, and that's support. He asked for help, and he received it. He spent hours outside of class working one-on-one with professors. And with Taylor's help, he got into the University of Illinois. Then he graduated.
Perry Klein.
That's Klein walking across the stage at his graduation from the U of I last month. Lots of people came to see him graduate, including his math professor from Parkland, Aaron Wilding Martin.
It was an emotional day. I was so proud of all the work that he's done.
And there's an English professor here who also likes to keep track of how he's doing and keep in touch. And I took a picture of him going across the stage and texted it to her. I'm not crying, you're crying.
Joni Schwartz says those kinds of emotional bonds between professors and formerly incarcerated students aren't unusual. They're actually necessary for students like Klein to succeed.
Someone who is there for them, accepts them unconditionally, and provides emotional, spiritual, academic support to them, that is key to their success.
Schwartz co-edited the book Race, Education, and Reintegrating Formerly Incarcerated Citizens. She says colleges need to proactively seek out formerly incarcerated people to offer that support. She suggests even going into the prisons to plant the seed that education is an option. Klein says getting his GED in prison planted that seed, and getting a college degree made all the difference in his life.
It's the floodgates to open up everything. I don't care what happened to you, you know, how your past went. Getting an education brings like so many possibilities.
Klein says he found his purpose in life, and that's helping others. He plans to pursue a master's degree in social work next. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
There are a lot of challenges in downstate Illinois: aging infrastructure, a shrinking population. Well, many communities are working to attract new residents and businesses, but that's difficult when there's not enough affordable middle-income housing. Reporter Madeline Beck with Illinois Newsroom found a bit of help is on the way.
The Quad Cities is made of a few Illinois towns and a few Iowa towns split by a state line over the Mississippi River. The sides have a lot in common, but in some ways, they're very different, like what happened to their old warehouses over the last 15 or so years.
Wow.
Yeah, bedrooms are on the way on the left and restrooms, and then these living rooms are just amazing.
That's Kyle Carter you hear talking. He's executive director of the Downtown Davenport Partnership. He and a few others are showing me a large, well-lit apartment with windows reaching the ceiling. It used to be part of an old office building, similar to the warehouses turned apartments all around it. But that was in Iowa, which has something called a State Historic Preservation Tax Credit. It was just enough to help get these projects built, and it often brings more money into an area than it costs in lost taxes. Tyler Power with the Quad Cities Chamber of Commerce says there is plenty of space for that tax credit to help add housing and jobs on the other side of the river.
We have a lot of untapped potential on the Illinois side, and we're excited to see the projects that get done with that.
That may happen soon. Starting this year, Illinois developers can apply for a state historic tax credit too. Now, yes, that's wonky, but let me break it down. That credit gives developers a tax break to fix up old buildings and turn them into rental housing or stores. And it can be used on top of other tax credits and local incentives. It could be a big deal for towns across Illinois that have large, underutilized buildings in their historic downtown. But there's a catch. The state is only shelling out $15 million a year in tax credits in the program. Here's Power again.
I feel for the people who have to decide which projects are best, because there's countless projects in probably every city that you go into, any downtown, all across the state of Illinois.
Technically, that limited funding could mean five big projects around Chicago could use up all the tax credit funds for a year. There's also more incentive to renovate spaces in bigger cities. That's because construction costs can be similar around the region, but buildings fetch higher prices in urban areas. So for small towns, they have to work harder, like many have for years. Some have shrunk, others stagnated, and still others have grown, but all are trying to bring in more people and businesses. But it's a chicken or the egg question. Housing first or jobs first? Just courting businesses won't be enough, according to John Griedel at the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs.
I think the way things are being reshaped in the country, especially with the millennials, they move to where they want to live first, and then they figure out how to make a living.
Griedel says that small towns are often focusing on bringing in businesses when they need to remember that housing is important too.
It might be time for the city council and the mayors to begin to reconsider, are we putting enough resources, both time and money, into housing as we are into business?
He and his colleagues at the Institute surveyed rural towns and found that there's a big need for quality middle-income houses, the kind that young entrepreneurs may want to buy and settle down in. But what if there aren't people making a middle-class wage to buy or rent new housing? The Rural Affairs Institute recommends town leaders first check what housing and jobs they already have and figure out where, in both, they can strategically invest for future growth. Meanwhile, developers recommend towns figure out what buildings or building blocks are ripe for state incentives. Then call folks who are already well-versed in using tax credits. Madeline Beck, Illinois Newsroom.
More of some of the best of 2019 on Statewide still to come. You're listening to a special Statewide. We're remembering some of the reporting that stood out to us in 2019, and we're glad you're with us. I'm Sean Crawford. On a cold night in Chicago's Roseland neighborhood, a group of volunteers stood along the streets as a physical show of support against sex trafficking. Natalie Moore, with member station WBEZ, went along with them.
Not for sale. And
the meetup spot was at 10 p.m. at Chicago Collegiate Charter School on 118th in Indiana. Inside, people warmed up with hot chocolate and sweets from the bakery Old Fashioned Donuts before trekking out, bundled up in the sub-zero weather. Tonight's organizer is community psychologist Kisha Roberts-Tabb. She's a Cook County human trafficking specialist and juvenile probation officer.
When black girls are exploited, they're usually called fast. They wanted to. They're highly sexual. And so I want them to know that we're not looking at them like that. We're looking at them like victims, because that's what they are. They're not fast girls. They're not loose girls.
Roberts-Tabb says these underaged girls are sold for sex. They are manipulated and likely know their pimps. Maybe it was someone they trusted, or maybe they were lured by their traffickers via social media. Trafficking is connected to poverty, violence, gangs, and drugs.
All of that is going on in Roseland, and so if we know that these are pathways for our girls, we need somebody that's willing to stand up and say, not tonight, not for sale, not this girl. You know, we want to be a representation for the young ladies that feel like they are voiceless.
She says Roseland is on her radar because the majority of her cases come from this area, with girls as young as 12. But in 2017, there was only one police arrest for human trafficking.
What does that tell you about what's going on in the neighborhood?
We know, based on the law, that girls cannot be arrested for prostitution if they're under the age of 18. They're coming in for other crimes like robberies, and the majority of the girls are coming in for juvenile arrest warrants because they go missing.
She says it's hard to prove human trafficking because exploited girls sometimes don't see themselves as victims.
And they listen, and then they really take action.
Volunteers, mostly women, but some men and some teenage girls, assemble love bags to pass out to any girls they see on the street. Bags have toiletries, resource materials, and Bible scriptures. A group huddles to say a prayer over the bags.
Oh God, and we know, oh God, that because of you, oh God, you told us to go out into all the world, oh God, and to save them, oh God.
And then breakout groups form to gather on various South Michigan Avenue corners. I go with a group headed out to 119th Street. Smaller groups post on all four corners of the intersection. Group leader Anita Bonds Davis tells the volunteers they need to stay for a little while longer. Across the street, another volunteer gives a teenager a love bag.
If you all don't mind, we're gonna stand out here until she gets on the bus, because Letty just gave her a bag. So I don't know whether or not.
How many buses just come? I'm just saying.
It's the Michigan bus got to come. The 119th bus went that way.
Okay.
And she's still standing here. So we're going to stand here until she.
3 minutes later, Bonds Davis comes back with info about the girl and the man standing next to her at the bus stop.
She's 16 years old. She just had a baby 3 days ago. Her mother's at work. And she said the guy's trying to talk to her. She really does not want to talk to him, but he's being persistent in talking to her, so we don't know if that's true or not.
She's got court for robbery soon. If she doesn't get on the bus, one of the women will take her home. Bonds Davis's 17-year-old daughter wants to go talk to her.
She want me to stand over there and talk to her? Here comes the bus. We'll see. No, I don't want you over there talking to her.
I'm her age.
Bonds Davis doesn't want her to. Everyone is waiting to see if the 16-year-old will get on the bus. The scenario raises flags. She's young, alone, and a grown man is trying to talk to her. She's in the criminal justice system. All signs, Kisha Roberts-Tabb said earlier, but no one knows for sure the circumstances. Finally, the 119th Street bus comes. The girl gets on, the man doesn't. Another telltale sign. And a volunteer says she bets the girl and the man know each other and that they're waiting for the group of volunteers to disperse. She sees the girl take out her phone on the bus and text someone. Natalie Moore, WBEZ News.
Illinois and many other states offer religious exemptions when it comes to vaccine requirements, but an outbreak of measles in New York led that state to join just a handful of others getting rid of religious exemptions. Sam Dunklaw took a look at whether Illinois could soon join them.
To understand why religious exemptions are a big deal in the public health realm, you have to understand what just happened in New York State.
Once declared eradicated in the United States, measles outbreaks are rattling regions of the country again this year.
There have been 588 cases of the measles in New York City since last October.
There have been 255 confirmed cases of measles in Rockland County since the beginning of June.
So measles cases were popping up all over the place. They seemed to be stemming from a few communities near New York City where families were refusing to vaccinate their kids for religious reasons. It's something a lot of states allow parents to do, and parents of some 26,000 kids across New York State did just that last school year. The problem is a lot of those kids were getting sick. It seemed like the New York State legislature should act, but what to do? Well, here's what they did.
An aggressive move in Albany. Governor Cuomo is eliminating religious exemptions for vaccines for school children.
That's New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Here he is.
I understand freedom of religion. We all do. We respect it. I've heard the anti-vaxxers theory, but I believe both are overwhelmed by the public health risk.
New York was just the latest state to do this. Maine joined the group earlier this year that includes California, Mississippi, and West Virginia. Diane Peterson with the Immunization Action Coalition says nearly all of them had a preventable disease outbreak.
It led many states to strengthen their process for getting a non-medical exemption. But what that has done in many instances is just pushed parents from maybe a personal exemption to the religious exemption.
Peterson says people all over the country have been claiming religious exemptions after they've talked to somebody who opposes vaccinations, a so-called anti-vaxxer. They claim there are a lot of reasons not to get them.
Claims such as vaccines might cause autism or too many harmful ingredients in the vaccine can lead to problems.
Claims, by the way, that have been disproven by science. Nonetheless, Peterson says, as states have gotten tougher on what exemptions to allow, a religious one is often a parent's only option. She says that's led to abuse. Now to the big question. Where does Illinois find itself in all of this? The state only allows religious exemptions to vaccines. Parents have to fill out a form, have their doctor sign it, and submit it to school administrators for approval. Illinois Public Health Director Ngazi Ezike says it's there for a reason.
We just want to make sure that people have understood what they may be refusing and maybe the risks of refusing and the benefits of immunization.
19,000 Illinois school kids used religious exemptions for vaccines last year, a 46% jump from years past. Meanwhile, 9 people in the state have come down with measles so far this year. While it's not a large number, it's the most since 2015. To drive that number down, Ezike says her team is looking at, quote, all the available options, which might include doing away with the religious argument for opting out. Which leads us to another question. Should Illinois do that? Here's Diane Peterson's take.
We need to come up with better immunization policy that does not allow for children to have these other exemptions.
And here's Barbara Lowe Fisher. She runs the National Vaccine Information Center, which advocates for what it calls informed consent.
We believe that people should be allowed to have all the information and make a voluntary decision without being punished for the decision that they make.
So far, Illinois lawmakers have avoided making a change. But what the state is doing right now is more telling. The Public Health Department got a $3 million funding boost for vaccine outreach, and the state is subsidizing vaccines for low-income kids, something it had stopped doing. For Illinois to go beyond, it might take a situation like what happened in New York, a public health emergency. I'm Sam Dunklaw.
Finally, on our 2019 wrap-up, it was just days after J.B. Pritzker became governor, our State House editor Brian Mackey decided to get to the heart of a controversy. It was a question that no one seemed to be able to answer, and it had repercussions throughout state government. It has a role in every law signed, and it flows from the highest office in the state, the Office of Governor. Now that we've piqued your interest, here's Brian with that report.
What we're really talking about here is a relatively small matter. And I mean literally small, like a poppy seed. I'm talking about periods, the punctuation marks you would expect to come after initials. Major media organizations have been using those periods on the name of Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. But that's not how the governor has been spelling it. Look, Illinois has big problems, from budget deficits to struggling human service agencies. But if reporters don't get little details right, we know you're going to wonder whether we're getting the big stuff right, too. So when it comes to the question of how to accurately write Pritzker's name, I knew I had to go to the source.
Hello. Hi. We have Brian here.
Brian, come on in.
Hello, Governor.
We're in the governor's private office in the east wing of the Capitol.
Typically, the way we begin an interview with someone, not usually necessary in your case, but we say, can you say and spell your name and what you do?
J.B. Pritzker. I'm governor of the state of Illinois.
Now, I notice you did not say J. period B. period Pritzker, and that is what a lot of newspapers say. Are there, in fact, no periods or periods in your first name or initials or whatever you want to call them?
Well, first of all, I find it hilarious that this is even a conversation. But here's the fact. My full name on my birth certificate, because I am named after my father's two brothers, my uncles, their official first names were J-A-Y, and Robert. But of course, Robert was known as Bob. So my name on my birth certificate is J. Robert Pritzker. But immediately upon emerging from the womb, my parents, and my father in particular, nicknamed me J.B., because he didn't want to offend either one of his older brothers by naming me Jay or Bob. And so J.B. was a way to honor both of them at the same time.
Pritzker says J.B. is the only name he's ever been called, but I still wanted to know when he decided to stop using periods. He says when he began his campaign for governor, his team presented him with a logo that did not include the punctuation. And that's how he's become known across the state.
So that started with a campaign. And at some point you decide, okay, I'm going to sign official, I mean, you're signing laws of Illinois with just JB and no periods. I mean, is that something you gave any thought to?
Well, let's just start with the fact that when I sign my name, you're getting into all kinds of complexity that I don't think much about. But when I sign my name on documents for many years, right, I mostly don't stop to put a period as you're scribbling your name, you know, in your signature form. You don't stop between letters. Typically, you're just signing. By virtue of you asking this question, I've really had to rack my brain, you know, if I've ever even thought about the initials, the periods themselves between them. But I can only tell you that it doesn't matter much to me.
The punctuation may not matter much to the governor, but like I said earlier, details do matter to reporters.
I guess I don't feel like I have a definitive answer, though, about whether to use periods in your name or not.
This will be one of the great mysteries of Illinois politics for hopefully many years.
We could end the story there, but on matters of style, we need a decision. Many of us rely on the Associated Press to settle these questions, so I emailed the corporate office in New York. Never heard back, but the AP style book says when someone uses initials instead of a first name, periods should be used. So, at least here at Public Radio, a governor named for men named Jay and Bob will remain J.B. Pritzker. And me, I'll remain Brian Mackey.
Well, that will put a bow on 2019 for statewide. We've listened back to some of the reports and conversations that stood out to us in the past year. We have plenty ahead as we welcome in 2020. And a reminder, if you miss any episode, you can always find them at statewideshow.com. Our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. We hope you'll join us next time and have a happy new year. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.